Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, cultural enrichment, and all-inclusive fares. Discover more at Viking.com.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Florida Governor Ron DeSantis clarifies his stance on Ukraine and goes on offense against Donald Trump as the grand jury in New York that's investigating the former president gets put on pause. Welcome, I'm Kyle Peterson with the Wall Street Journal. We are joined today by my colleagues, editorial board member Kate Batchelder-Odell and columnist Kim Strassel. Welcome and happy Friday to you both. In a statement last week, Governor DeSantis said that it is not in America's national interest to become, quote, further entangled in a territorial dispute between Ukraine and Russia, unquote. He went on to criticize what he called the Biden administration's virtual blank check funding of this conflict. But after some criticism, including at the Wall Street Journal editorial page, DeSantis is adding some nuance to that response. Here he is speaking this week with Piers Morgan on Fox Nation.
I think it's been mischaracterized. Obviously, Russia invaded that. That was wrong. They invaded Crimea and took that in 2014. That was wrong. What I'm referring to is kind of where the fighting is going on now, which is that western border or eastern border region, Donbas, and then Crimea. And you have a situation where Russia has had that, I don't think legitimately, but they've had, there's a lot of ethnic Russians there. So that's some difficult fighting. And so whatever, the conflict area, that's what I was referring to. And so it wasn't that I thought Russia had a right to that. And so if I should have made that more clear, I could have done it.
Kate, would you characterize that as a bit of a walk back, or is there a way to square these new comments with what Governor DeSantis said last week?
I think, Kyle, that it's unquestionably a walk back. And I think also that if DeSantis thought better of his other remarks about it being a territorial dispute, which was a statement that was given to a cable news host, if he thought better of that exercise, that's a good thing that he's responding to some criticism and taking a different tack. Now, I do think that there are some notable things in these new remarks here, and he's really stopped short of articulating what he really thinks of the world and what America's place in it is. So we hear him say that a couple things in here, which is that Putin was wrong to invade, Putin is hostile to the United States. But he also says, since China's a bigger challenge, that's where more of our focus should be. And so what we're not seeing is any case of why it might be in the U.S. interest to help Ukraine evict Putin and why we should connect that challenge with the challenge we're facing in the Pacific with China. So I think here what we have is an incremental improvement and definitely a little bit of a pivot here, Kyle, but I am not seeing kind of a fuller articulation that I think voters are going to want from Mr. DeSantis if he decides to run for president.
That seems right to me. I mean, it looks to me like DeSantis is trying to run down the middle of this coming Republican primary field. He knows there are some people who are skeptical of this aid to Ukraine. He knows there are some Republicans who support it, and he is trying to hedge a little bit on both sides, I think. I mean, I take his point about some of that territory in eastern Ukraine, that if there's going to be a negotiated settlement to this conflict between Ukraine and Russia, you know, who knows what that might look like and where the territorial boundary might be drawn in the end. But I think Kate is right to go after the lack of clarity on this. I mean, he keeps saying things like peace should be the objective. And Kim, I think for everybody, peace is the objective. But the question is, peace on what terms? And are they terms that you can get Vladimir Putin to agree on now? Or how long is that going to take? He's also said things like a policy of regime change in Russia would greatly increase the stakes of the conflict. And so, Kim, I mean, I don't see anybody talking about going in and trying to overthrow Putin. I mean, I see people sometimes say that, wouldn't it be nice if that was the eventual result of this? But it's hard to see anybody in the Biden administration setting that forth as U.S. policy. And so I think there remain a lot of questions about what a DeSantis administration policy would actually look like. And I agree with Kate that if he gets into this 2024 presidential race, he's going to have to answer those questions when he steps up to the debate stage.
I agree, Kyle. Some of the things that he has been saying have mostly been straw men laying out these potential scenarios that could be really dreadful and destabilizing, even though no one's talking about him. And yes, it is a hedge, but I don't think it's a terribly great place for him to be. Look, I want to be clear, it's better than where he was when he was writing this off as a territorial dispute, but a couple of problems with this. One, voters don't really like hedging. Okay, they appreciate a politician who can be nuanced, but this in a certain way does come across as a little political. It sounds a bit as if, as you said, DeSantis wants to not lose a grip on some of those voters who have decided to go all in on the Trump position, that this is not America's conflict to be engaged in. And this claim, which is nonsense, that somehow we cannot walk and chew gum at the same time. We can't both be a powerful player on the world scene and look after our own domestic interests, as if there's some sort of trade-off there. So he wants that, and probably also got some real blowback from those earlier comments he made. And, you know, as we all know, presidential campaigns, a lot of things happen behind the scenes. You have to bet that some of his allies who are out there, they want to endorse him when he gets in, had some concern. Maybe he heard from some donors. He clearly got the message and he needed to sound a little bit more forward-facing and aggressive on this issue. But the reason this really, I think, undermines him is voters, when it comes to presidential candidates, they appreciate genuineness. And that is something that has very much been in DeSantis' favor. He's taken a lot of positions. He's known exactly what he's about. This instead, as I said, it feels a little bit more calculated. And those are the kind of things that can hurt you as a candidate. So I think he'd be far better off instead of also doing these piecemeal things where he's answering a questionnaire, doing a one-off interview, he's only going to get a few minutes to talk about a subject. He ought to wait a little bit. When he decides to get in the race, go out and deliver a real presidential address where you lay out your foreign policy visions.
The other difficulty of being calculating in a situation like this, it seems to me, is that if you're trying to read the room, you may be reading what the room looks like right now, but this is a dynamic situation on the ground in Ukraine. Here's a Wall Street Journal headline from the last day or so. Ukraine sees Russian losses in Bakhmut as paving way for spring offensive. Moscow's faltering assault on the eastern city supports Kyiv's decision to defend it. And so, Kate, part of what is difficult here for these candidates who are trying to take the temperature of the Republican Party is there's a long time on the ground there in Ukraine between now and when these Republican voters are going to be actually going to the polls. And when they do that, it won't be based on what has happened over the last year. It'll be based on what's going to happen over the next year and what the situation on the ground looks like, whether the Russian offensive continues and gains ground or whether the Ukrainian counteroffensive takes back some of the territory and the Biden investment in some of these systems that the U.S. is sending over there looks like it is paying off.
Yeah, Kyle. So I think if you look at polling, about 40% of Republicans are telling pollsters now that we're doing too much for Ukraine, too much to support Ukraine. And so Republicans have responded by basically assuming that, oh, the base doesn't want to support Ukraine anymore. I think that there's some things going on that are a little more complicated. One, I think it's a pretty polarized political environment, and Joe Biden being in charge of the Ukraine operation has led some Republicans to oppose it. I also think that Joe Biden's not really out there making the case for why supporting Ukraine is in the U.S. interest. And he's saying things that great GOP voters, like that this is about in the international community or democracy and not U.S. interest. So I think that it would be premature to conclude what Republicans really think about Ukraine is that we shouldn't be helping them. And to your point about how dynamic the battlefield is, I mean, if Joe Biden were to say, start giving Ukraine the tools it really needs to win, and we start flowing in longer range missiles, and the situation really improves, well, then Republicans will have surrendered an argument that they are the party that you should trust on national security, and Joe Biden will get credit for that success. Now, if Joe Biden doesn't do that, and if the situation gets materially worse for Ukraine on the ground, you could have Putin basically regroup and try to launch a fresh offensive. One thing that really struck me that DeSantis said was basically, well, I don't think Putin's going to win, and that's good. That would be good, Kyle, but it is really too early, I think, to conclude that Putin's not going to win. I think he still thinks he can grind down the West and wait us out. And if that happens, Kyle, to your point, is that the kind of world that Ron DeSantis wants to inherit in January of 2025? I think that's a question that all Republicans should be asking themselves as they try to carve out a position on Ukraine.
The other piece of news that Governor DeSantis made this week was Monday at a press conference when he addressed the New York District Attorney Alvin Bragg's investigation into President Trump and the hush money payments that he made to Stormy Daniels amid the 2016 campaign. Listen to this.
I don't know what goes into paying hush money to a porn star to secure silence over some type of alleged affair. I can't speak to that. But what I can speak to is that if you have a prosecutor who is ignoring crimes happening every single day in his jurisdiction, And he chooses to go back many, many years ago to try to use something about porn star hush money payments. You know, that's an example of pursuing a political agenda and weaponizing the office.
Kim, what do you make of that? I guess it strikes me as a pretty sly answer, telling people that this conduct may not be criminal, it may be prosecutorial overreach, but at the same time, reminding voters that this was sordid business.
It was very clever. He certainly got in a slap, and it was a big one at Donald Trump. Now, he put himself in the right position in the end, right? Because there's a lot of Republicans out there that whatever their views of Donald Trump as a candidate or a potential president, and again, they have a lot of issues, and understandably, with this prosecution that Alvin Bragg is threatening, because it seems to fall along the lines of yet another very weak, poorly considered prosecution and the targeting of Donald Trump because he's a Republican and because he's Donald Trump. So DeSantis is making sure that he is calling that out. And we have had other Republican candidates who have done the same thing. But this was in keeping, Kyle. He also came out in the Piers Morgan interview. He had some other criticisms of Trump that went well beyond this question of this payment in terms of Trump's governing style. He, for instance, was making the contrast, saying, you know, I would have fired Dr. Fauci. I would have handled COVID differently. If I were in office, I would be focused on getting the right people, on no drama, on getting points on the board. So he's clearly now deciding he's going to make that contrast. He's going to make the contrast on the personal aspects of this, bringing up Trump's past, generally reminding voters that where Trump goes, there tends to be a lot of controversy. And he's also going to start making the comparison on terms of governance and priorities and leadership. Clearest indication yet he is getting in and that he's not going to back away from the person who is going to be the biggest front runner other than him if he does.
Right. DeSantis also said recently, this is in an interview, that the way we run the government, I think, is no daily drama. Focus on the big picture and put points on the board. That, again, I think was a contrast intended at the chaotic years of the Trump administration. He also said, I have what it takes to be president and I can beat Biden. But notable that Ron DeSantis is not an announced candidate for president in 2024, even though he is ranking high in some of the polling. This is a Monmouth University poll from a couple days ago. Asked who you want to see as the Republican nominee for president, the number one answer is Donald Trump, 41%. Ron DeSantis, 27%, and don't know, 23%. But then asked if it's a head-to-head matchup between Trump and DeSantis, you get a much closer race. Trump, 47%, and DeSantis, 46%. And so, Kate, I mean, it's notable, those poll numbers. And given the comments that DeSantis is making, it certainly sounds like getting into this 2024 race is a question of when and not a question of if.
Yeah, Kyle, it certainly looks that way. And I was fascinated by some of the spots he chose on Trump, too, to go after him, and has clearly decided that there's an opening for somebody to win and persuade some of Trump's voters to praise President Trump's policies when they were good, such as tax reform. We didn't see a lot of discussion of this, but I think this is what DeSantis generally has in mind, is not alienating Trump's voters, winning them over, but also criticizing him on his polarizing style and the things that he was wrong about. We're also seeing, you know, Trump is putting out these statements about DeSantis, calling him Ron DeSanctimonious, which I don't really think works as a nickname. And that novelty of that Trump approach that existed in 2016 has really, by this point, worn off. So I do think that there is an opening here. And I think that COVID will become one of the more interesting disputes. I think it's going to be really tough for Trump to portray Ron DeSantis, who is being called Ron DeathSantis, as insufficiently skeptical of lockdowns. I think that Florida was obviously an early adopter of opening it up. Businesses didn't close schools, you know, kept the beaches open. That was controversial at the time, and I think voters remember it. So I think some of this is going to be really uphill for Trump, and Ron DeSantis is carving out a good lane in that regard by, you know, brushing some of this off while not going on a moral crusade against every single thing Trump did and all of his voters.
Hang tight. We'll be right back. You're listening to Potomac Watch from the Wall Street Journal.
The Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin. Investment professionals reveal their best mentors, how they find their next great idea, and a few funny stories. Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. American Funds Distributors, Inc.
Don't forget, you can reach the latest episode of Potomac Watch anytime. Just ask your smart speaker, play the Opinion Potomac Watch podcast.
From the opinion pages of the Wall Street Journal, this is Potomac Watch.
Welcome back. Speaking of New York District Attorney Alvin Bragg, his grand jury in this Stormy Daniels case was the dog that didn't bark this week. Remember, President Trump said over the weekend that he expected to be arrested on Tuesday, and yet the grand jury took a couple days off this week. On Monday, I believe, it heard from another witness who came in, and according to his own explanations to the press, he came in and tried to impugn the testimony of former Trump fixer Michael Cohen. And so, Kim, I mean, it's hard to know what's going on inside this closed process. The grand jury is a little bit of a black box, but it's hard to know whether the grand jury is having second doubts based upon this new testimony it heard about the credibility of Michael Cohen, or whether maybe Alvin Bragg is having second doubts based on a lot of criticism from many corners all across the spectrum, the political spectrum, that maybe this prosecution is not such a bright idea.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of theories. It's impossible to know. I mean, one is that you got to remember, Alvin Bragg is bringing what you can only describe as an extremely tenuous case here. He essentially wants to claim that Trump falsified a business record. Only the problem is that that's a misdemeanor in New York, and it's also moot given that there's a 2-year statute of limitations, and these payments to Michael Cohen finished in 2017. So instead, he's trying to bump this into a felony by claiming a charge of falsification in aid of another crime, which also requires him to then hinge that charge on yet another one that somehow the Trump Organization payment broke campaign finance laws. It gets even more complicated. Campaign finance laws are very convoluted. Meanwhile, the main witness here is Michael Cohen, is a convicted perjurer. There's just a lot weighing down this case. So could be that that testimony early in the week gave the jury some second doubts. Could be that Alvin Bragg is having some second doubts. Could be that he's taking some more time to try to find another witness of his own to rebut some of that testimony the grand jury heard. Could be that the grand jury was simply involved in another case for a while, in that when these grand juries meet, they don't always exclusively just focus on one case. Sometimes they are managing a number of them. We're not going to know for a while yet. I would like to hope that Alvin Bragg is rethinking this because of the potential consequences of it. But I guess we're going to remain on suspended animation watch until at least next week.
In the meantime, though, this case is sucking a lot of the oxygen out of the political arena. One notable development this week was House Republicans, particularly Jim Jordan, congressman from Ohio, chairman of the Judiciary Committee, sent a letter to Alvin Bragg asking for materials related to his investigation. Bragg has rejected that idea. But Kate, what do you make of this, the idea of a federal body, federal legislative committee, demanding to do oversight of a local state prosecutor?
Kyle, it's bad on the merits. It's worse on the politics. Bragg is not going to cooperate and he will have the law on his side. But I am just as concerned, Kyle, with the fact that this is just so distracting from the things that House Republicans should be focused on. I mean, there is a coming budget fight and the House Republicans don't have a budget resolution yet, for instance. They really need to be focused on their priorities and what they're going to tell the country about how they would govern if they were given either the Senate or the White House in 2024. So I think wasting precious political capital with such a thin House majority on a project like this is both a legal and political mistake. And it would be an unforced error to just ladle this other abuse on top of the abuse that we might see from Bragg here.
Well, Kim, we'll give you the last word, but the questions that a lot of people have been debating about are whether a charge against Donald Trump in this case would help or hurt his 2024 candidacy. And maybe it depends on which segment of voters you're talking about, but it does seem like there are many unknowns, in particular how closely Republicans outside of Trump's campaign continue to try to defend him, and what Trump's ultimate reaction to a charge would be. He has called for protests, and this is a tweet, I guess it's a Truth Social post about 14 hours ago. He says, "What kind of a person can charge another person, in this case, a former president of the United States who got more votes than any sitting president in history, .. when it is known by all that no crime has committed and also known that potential death and destruction in such a false charge could be catastrophic for our country." And it is not clear to me, Kim, exactly what he's talking about there, but if there are protests after a Trump indictment and there is death and destruction involved on them, I mean, it seems to me like that would push this more toward the side of this harming Trump's 2024 candidacy and Republicans perhaps regretting defending him so to the hilt?
It's hard to know how this will play. You know, I think Kate made a really good point earlier about DeSantis hitting Trump for the things that Trump deserves to be hit on and also pulling out some of his good parts of his record. And you saw DeSantis, you know, taking a swing at him over this payment to a former mistress. This is designed to remind people that Donald Trump, again, does have a lot of baggage when he comes around. And that has caused some people to say, well, you know, the fact that he's now being hauled up, he could potentially get handcuffed. Maybe this is going to make voters say, you know, we're tired of this drama. We want something new, especially Republican primary voters. But here's my problem, though. I tend to look at what Democrats do. They don't always do everything right. But there's clearly a reason they want Donald Trump in the headlines all the time, front and center. And it's because they know he's very polarizing. They know he's polarizing to the base, but also very polarizing to incredibly important key sections of the general electorate, including suburban voters. And they feel if they can keep him in the news, tie him to the Republican Party, make him the continual figurehead of that party, that it's going to be to their electoral benefit. And by the way, that did help them, obviously, in the most recent midterm. So far, that assessment has been correct. So I am in the category of those who think that, you know, Donald Trump might like this because it'll keep him in the headlines, and he loves to be in the headlines. Whether or not that's good for the Republican Party overall, I think is very hard to make the case that it is, especially when Democrats, you know, they can point out that if Trump were to become the nominee, they know they can beat him because they've already done it before.
Thank you, Kim and Kate. Thank you all for listening. You can email us at pwpodcast@wsj.com. If you like the show, please hit that subscribe button, and we'll be back next week with another edition of Potomac Watch.
This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ.